This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Guys, welcome to the Audacity Network and welcome to another episode of The Sit Down. Today, I have a special guest on the channel. He has a YouTube channel with 1.2 million subscribers arguing the case for and educating people about Islam. Welcome to the show, Muhammad Hijab.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming. So I think when I first... when I first decided to have you on the show, you messaged me something about a lot of my views are similar to Islam. So I was curious, what views?
Well, of course, I mean, look, if I'm being open and transparent with you, what's happened, let's take this historically, because what's happened in the West is that there was the feminist movement, and you had two major waves, the first wave and the second wave. First wave of feminism, maybe you could say after the 1920s, and it focused on the vote and stuff, right? That's probably a point of difference. I don't have an issue with the vote. I know that you've been tweeting about the woman's vote. To be honest, I see
it as it's the root of all evil.
No, I think you haven't argued that point well enough, to be honest. We can talk about that. Yeah. But the second wave feministic output, okay, this is where a lot of the issues of society that we would agree as Muslims, traditionalist Muslims, would be. Because it's not just about equal pay and all that kind of thing. I don't have an issue with equal pay. It's about domestic drudgery. It's about the new attitude that the West is now having vis-a-vis the mother, vis-a-vis the family unit, vis-a-vis what is success, what constitutes a success for a woman in general. And that was, or could be conceived to be diametrically opposed to traditional values in Islam, Judaism, Christianity, and cross-culturally, historically, for a very long time. So the fact that there's been a response to it, some academics have labeled this as the backlash literature, okay? So that you've had from the 60s to like 2000, you've had all this feminist output, and now people are coming out and responding to it. And one of the first books that I came across was a book called The Myth of Male Power. I'm not sure if you've come across a very important one by Worrell Farrin. And he kind of set the trend a little bit, I think, academically. Then you had a range of different outputs. And I would compartmentalize the outputs into two different types. You had what you would call academic output. So people like James Tooley has a very interesting book called The Miseducation of Women. Yeah, very good book. It's part of the backlash literature. For instance, right? We've already mentioned Worrell Farrin. But then on the other hand, you had the cultural leaders, people that were making sound, you know, noise on the internet and stuff like that. And I think probably the most effective person was Andrew Tate. Okay, I think we would all agree. If there was one person that...
Phenomenal.
Yeah, one person.
Who else has had like a media rise like that?
Yeah.
Overnight, basically.
Absolutely. So you have people like Andrew Tate, and I would say Kevin Samuels as well,
from
a cultural perspective. And I would put Sneeko and yourself and other people in that same bracket. Now, this is usually referred to as the red pill movement or something like that. Obviously, from an academic perspective, there's not much that has been produced from a red pill perspective. Only Rollo Tomasi has really, I would say, put in effort in that regard, notable effort. He's written his book, The Rational Male. I'm not sure if you've come across it or you've spoken to him about it.
Yeah.
But that seems to be an organized set of ideas of some sorts. Apart from that, the red pill movement has been, I would say, the most loud kind of cultural producer of knowledge, if you like, and attitudes, which has been a response to feminism since the 60s. That's what I think. That's the history of it. And so I think everyone deserves their recognition as part of that movement. But I also think that the red pill movement has gone into overcorrect mode. And you know, sometimes when the pendulum swings too much in one direction, it swings an equal and opposite amount in the other direction. And I do think that there are some things in the Red Pill movement, which I've already voiced, you know, with many different podcasts recently, Fresh and Fit, which I think are also not right or incorrect or incoherent or whatever. However, a lot of the stuff needed to be said, I must say. And so where I think what you've said agrees with Islam or agrees with the position, which I would say is more favorable to women anyway, from a psycho-spiritual perspective, is obviously the focus on traditional roles, obedience to the husband, which is a very, I mean, to say obedience to the husband in the 60s and 70s, when the feminist movement was fresh, would be blasphemous, sacrilegious. And for someone, okay, to come out and speak about that, as in yourself and other people, is definitely seen as very audacious, no pun intended, obviously, this place is called audacity, right?
Yeah.
Very audacious thing to do. Mm-hmm. And very, in our sense, very praiseworthy. Mm-hmm. You know, in our religion, for example, in Islam, and I would say in Judaism as well, and I would say traditional forms of Christianity, in all three Abrahamic, yeah, quote-unquote, religions, this has always been a thing, you know. This has always been a thing. And cross-culturally, and once again, historically, this has always been a thing. And there's good evidence to suggest that this kind of family unit, this kind of structure, is what brings people happiness, contentment. It makes a better living for children, for families. It's good evidence. I'll give you one piece of evidence. The longest study that has ever been produced on the well-being of women in the West is a study called Blanche Flower and Oswald, okay, which took place between the 1970s until 2000. And you'll note that this study took place after the 60s, after many of the laws had now been passed in America and in the UK and other places, which gave women the right to work and, you know, equal pay and all these kind of things, abortion, all that kind of stuff. All right, but then what we find is that we find that women are now finding it harder. According to this study, they have become more dissatisfied. So obviously we can't say correlation equals causation, but what we're saying is there's good evidence to suggest, even to the extent to which even the founding mothers of feminism, like Betty Friedan and others, they acknowledged that the feminist movement now took a shape of its own, and it was having an impact on women's health. Mm-hmm. You know, she said it herself. Betty Friedan, who wrote obviously The Feminine Mystique in 1963, in the 70s and 80s, she came and said that this movement now has become religious, the feminist movement. And what she had said about...
It's become religious?
Yes, it's become something which even she tried to stop it from being like that.
Oh, so...
The feminism had become like pseudo-religious.
Okay.
You see what I mean?
I thought you meant like what? I was like, what religion is
that? No, I mean, when I say religious...
Like satanic?
When I say religious, yeah. I mean like it's taking on the traits of someone who believes in feminism.
Right.
Exhibits the same physiological and psychological traits as someone who follows a religion would exhibit.
Mm-hmm.
So she acknowledged that, and she realized, she actually conducted her own study, okay, in her second book that she wrote, The Second Sage, and she said that women's health had become worse. So there's no evidence that feminist prescriptions have been good for society. And where we agree wholeheartedly and definitely is on the point that, okay, we need to go back to a more traditional,
right,
way of living, and that's better for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, where we disagree is that, look, I mean, some things like, I would say, the stuff that you just mentioned, like, you know, the woman's voting and stuff, mother of all of you, I don't know if the argument has been made strongly enough, if I'm being honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know if you've made the argument strongly
enough. I actually do say that some women can vote.
Yes.
If they're not on child support.
Okay.
Alimony, they're, yeah, net taxpayers, they're in the military or have an infrastructure job. My point is, if we made those the requirements, maybe landowners, business owners, but if we made that the requirement, most women wouldn't vote anyway.
look, do you know, so, historically,
we're going to go to technicality, you know.
Look, historically, okay, look, there's a difference between representative democracy and direct democracy,
yeah,
right? Democracy came out from Athens, you know, thousands of years ago, maybe 2,500, 2,400 years ago. And actually, in the first instance, at least in Athens, not in Sparta and other places, but the women were excluded from the vote. I mean, Plato has a whole criticism of voting for the commoners. And he says that the people who should vote are those who are like the elites, the intellectual elites, because why should we have dumb people voting anyway in society? That's his position. I would say that position is much more respectable than yours, though, but only because it's like what you've said can be applicable to certain groupings of men.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
What do you?
If you think about it, right, there are some people. Let's say, for example, we can do this in a myriad ways. If you've got a woman who's a PhD, right, And she's a specialist in a specific area. Then you've got a man who,
I find that PhDs these days, it doesn't
fair
mean...
Fair enough. Yeah, okay, let's go to the conventional race realist favorite go-to thing, IQ.
Okay, fine.
Okay.
IQ.
Let's say a man does an IQ test and he gets 50 and a woman gets 150. Okay.
See, I'm different. I don't really believe in IQ tests, but yeah.
Me and you both. I mean, I have my own criticism of the IQ
test. Okay, but yeah, fine.
I do have
fine. I understand.
But what I'm trying to say is that, like, you know, it's if it's based on prudence, then we have to now, if you say, okay, well, there's certain segments of society that shouldn't vote over a certain age, and that's based on prudence, then let's put the parameters there, and you're gonna not include a lot of men in there as well.
Yeah, well, I don't think men that don't pay taxes don't, you know, I don't think men that, like, are on benefits should really vote either. I just don't think it's fair that, like, I think the problem we keep getting into is people that are living off the system keep voting for more and more handouts. And that's kind of the issue that I have with it. And women are just the majority of people on benefits. So.
Well, women are a majority of people on benefits. So now this is not an argument about who's best at choosing the right politics. It's about not including people who take from the system or they're using their vote.
Yeah, true. But I'm saying it's mostly women that take from the system.
Sure, but then if we say the same thing, one can respond to that quite easily and say, well, look at the bankers in this country, for example, right? They get away with the most. They've got the most money coming in, but they get away with the most. They don't have to pay anything in terms of taxes and stuff like that. They threaten and leverage the government and so on.
How?
So
I don't know enough about bankers.
So, for example, like in 2008, there was a recession, which was a worldwide recession, but obviously was felt particularly heavily here in the UK, in London, and so on. And, you know, the government had to bail out the bankers. You know, and this led to a lot of consternation and resentment in the mass population.
Oh, so is that like we had that 2007, 2008?
Yeah, same thing.
Oh, okay, same thing happened here.
Same thing, but the idea is that it's not a correct thing to think that it's only the, let's say, working class socioeconomic grouping that gets to leverage the government, say, or use the government or use the vote to enact policies which are in its best interest, aside from the interest of, say, the majority of people. Because the bankers and the elites also do the same thing.
Well, I guess, because I think are you saying that I'm saying the middle class wouldn't vote then?
No, I'm just saying that depending on, like, what parameter we use.
Yeah.
So, for example, if we say, let's use an IQ parameter, let's use an intelligence parameter.
Right.
Well, it's not going to be whatever parameter we use, it doesn't seem like it's going to be a gender issue then.
Well, I think whatever parameter we use, women would still mostly not vote. Because I would include infrastructure. Like, I think the plumbers should be able to vote, the electric, like, people actually running the backbone of society. I just think there has to be some skin in the game.
Yeah.
The
thing is, when we say skin in the game, is this would be a bit of a tension between what you say here and then what you say that women should do. Because, correct me if I'm wrong, but your idea of women should be at home, right? As homemakers.
Sort of, but yeah, mostly. If you have children, yes.
Sure, okay, so they don't have any skin in the game, in that sense, because they're not paying taxes if they're at home. So you can't send these women signals, you know.
Then you get your husband voting. You're supposed to listen to him anyway, right?
No, I get what you're saying. I understand what you're saying, but you see, like, whatever parameter you use, you're going to see an issue with it. That's why you have to rethink these arguments a little bit. Maybe you just...
But even the homemaker, it's not like most women are homemakers anyway. In this society, so no,
isn't
it wouldn't
something
be the
you want to change. I mean, there's
well, I think it would be better, but I wouldn't predict it. I guess I'm kind of I'm like a happy pessimist.
Okay,
I don't think that's going to happen in my lifetime if I had to guess.
Yeah, so that's one issue that we disagree on. It's not necessarily, I just disagree because I don't think the force of the argument is there. I think you need to think about the argument a bit stronger. That's all, and just because. So that's one thing. I mean, but the other thing I think is an approach, though, because, you know, I've gone through your channel, not all of the videos, but mostly the shorts. I think your shorts have done very well. Part of your success has been your shorts, hasn't it? And there was a theme there. I mean, look, once again, everyone can do their own thing. I'm not. But the theme was, okay, women need to take accountability. And I agree with that theme. Do you know what I mean? Like, okay, women need to take accountability. But I also think men should take accountability. Okay, so how do we do this? Because if you tell people that, okay, you need to take accountability, for example, women, right? Modern women are the least accountable of any generation. Mm-hmm. But so are modern men. Like, compare the modern man with the medieval man. He fails in almost every metric. Mm-hmm. Men are now junkies. They are, you know, desperados. They are, you know, losers. Mm-hmm. A lot of men in the West and elsewhere, not just in the Muslim world as well. Mm-hmm. Compare them with their medieval equivalent in terms of warrior status and what they've done on the battlefield, in terms of what they do in terms of protecting their family. Mm-hmm. So I do think that, because here's the thing, I think with relationships, we have a trend now of people, both men and women, trying to deflect blame. Mm-hmm. So a lot of men, yes, the red pill stuff, it resonates with them. Mm-hmm. And for good reason. Because the people in the red pill are saying things that need to be said. And I'm the first one to admit this. Mm-hmm. That women need to take accountability, that women need to obey their husband, all that kind of stuff, traditional roles, all that kind of thing. I agree with that. You know, I'm a Muslim. At the end of the day, we're conservative. We're very conservative. We're more conservative than any conservative in the West. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if we really think about it, we're so conservative that wouldn't even be called conservatism anymore.
Be far right. Yeah.
No, not far right. Because the whole spectrum, the political spectrum, yeah, from a Western perspective is different.
Oh my gosh, it's way more in depth than I thought. Yeah. Like, when I first got into it, I was like, I'm conservative. But there's like so many different layers that I didn't even know before I got into it.
Because the issue is with conservatism is that it depends on, like in America, they have neoconservatism. Yeah. In England, you have traditional conservatism that was like promulgated by someone like Edmund Burke. And all of it is not what we are. Mm-hmm. But we have aspects of conservative ideology, which we agree. But the point I was making was this, is that I do think that, like, the message is partly right. Mm-hmm. And as I say, we agree with it, but there needs to be a bit more pushing accountability for men as well. And there needs to be a bit more conciliatory mm-hmm. approach.
What's conciliatory?
Like harmonizing. You know, we want to harmonize between, because the thing is, at the end of the day, men and women can't live without each other. Mm-hmm. And we need to get along with each other. Mm-hmm. I've met many women who are embittered, and I've met many men who are embittered. Like, they've either had a bad breakup, or someone's taken money from them, or their ex-wife has taken half their wealth. All of this stuff I disagree with. However, and that needs to be called out. Mm-hmm. But I do feel like that there's a time now we need to try and get men and women together to work as partners rather than as competitors.